Hello and welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's show, one of the great movie beauties of our time, Penelope Cruz, who lends her Latin emoción to the latest Woody Allen movie, Vicky Cristina Barcelona. And the undisputed master of modern computer animation, John Lasseter, gives me a rare interview about the dog's life of Bolt. And I'll be sniffing out this week's major releases, including Meryl Streep in Doubt and Brad Pitt in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. It's as hot as a Christian Bale tantrum. It's Film Weekly. After a dispiriting decade of critical and commercial knocks, Woody Allen returns this week with Vicky Cristina Barcelona, his 40th feature film that could be make or break for the great man's remaining career. So it's fitting that the film is about one thing. Seduction. And with a stellar cast, including No Country for Old Men star Javier Bardem, Scarlett Johansson, Rebecca Hall, and the beautiful Penelope Cruz, a more seductive cast could not have been gathered. The film tells the story of two American women, Vicky and Cristina, on a summer break in Barcelona. They encounter the seductive Juan, played by Javier Bardem, and, unfortunately, his unhinged ex-wife, Maria Elena, played by Penelope Cruz. In one of the nicer parts of my weekly round, I met up with Penelope Cruz to discuss her Oscar and BAFTA-nominated role as the fiery Maria Elena. But first, before we hear from her, let's hear from Penelope in action in Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
But you do have talent.
No.
Yes.
What's my talent?
You take beautiful photographs.
That's true. She always takes pictures that she hides from me.
That's because they're nothing. How do you know I take pictures?
I found them in your luggage.
You went through my luggage?
Of course I went through your luggage. First night I was in the house, I didn't trust you. I didn't believe you were who you said you were. I wanted to know who was really sharing the bed of my ex-husband.
What?
Who knew what I would find there? How could I be sure you were not going to hurt me? After all, I have thoughts of killing you.
Penelope Cruz, lovely to see you. Congratulations
on your
Oscar nomination and your BAFTA nomination.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited.
Yeah, does it mean things to you to
of
be nominated?
Of course, it's a huge thing for me. You know, I grew up in Spain, in a not even in the city, in the outskirts of Madrid. Mm-hmm. For me, when I was growing up, to dream about making a living out of acting seemed like a crazy idea. Seemed almost impossible. I didn't have anybody around me with the similar type of life. Yeah. So when these things happen, I still feel very overwhelmed and most of all, extremely grateful, mm-hmm. You know.
Tell me about working with Woody Allen, because you say that there's fear, but I suppose every actress wants to work with Woody Allen. And do you know that he's the director with the most nominations for his actresses of any director?
Really?
Mm. Oh, if you work with Woody, you're going to get a nomination. Well, it seems every time, you know, for something about him, writing for women, mm-hmm. he has his extraordinary knowledge of female roles that he has. I don't know if you found that working with him.
Yes, I think him and Pedro Almodovar have written some of the best material for women. They have an appreciation for women, for how neurotic we are sometimes. And I think they love women and they love to explore that and they really know as well.
This cast in particular, obviously it reminded me of, I suppose, the female cast of Almodovar in a way, and maybe that was in Woody Allen's mind when he's doing his first film in Spain, to slight homage to Almodovar. Did he ever talk about Pedro with you?
Well, they both really admired each other, so they would give each other messages through me, and I was so happy to be the messenger.
What, little bits of paper, or...?
No, just tell him this and tell him that, and I love that they get along so well. And
what did they say?
No, always send them good wishes, you know, for the set or for the opening. When we went to Cannes, Pedro was calling from Madrid, and they really admire and like each other.
Was Pedro thrilled for you when you told him you'd be working with Woody Allen?
Yes, very much. Yes, yes.
I can imagine, I don't know with Woody Allen this time, but did you know the rest of the cast? Did you know the story that you would be going into? Because often he doesn't show people the script.
Yeah, he gave us the script months before.
All of you?
Yes.
Ah, he's changed his ways. Sometimes he only gives a part to one.
To me, he said, he wrote me a letter and he gave it to me just to get ready, and because he doesn't do any rehearsals.
Is that weird for you, not rehearsing?
Different, very different, but I didn't mind because I trust Woody 100%. said, okay, this is the way he likes working. There has to be a reason for him to want to do it that way. And you jumped into that adventure.
Did you? You didn't do any auditions, I assume?
No, he didn't ask me to. He saw Volver, and that's when he told me that he was writing a character that maybe was going to be right for me.
It's an interesting part for you. I've never seen you do this part. I suppose that's why everyone is so delighted with you. Was it fun to play? Because I don't know if it's the side of your character. You seem very calm today, but this woman is, as you say, a little bit neurotic, as you mentioned before.
Very. No, I'm not too similar to her, fortunately, but I love her, and I understand her, and I didn't want to laugh at that pain. I know that pain is funny, but I was not the one to laugh about it or to be too aware of it on set.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to play a character that explored mental instability, and I thought it was one of the most cruel mysteries of life. Mm. How hard those things are to define, and how abstract the concept of craziness or sanity.
And what makes us go there, which is sometimes love or sometimes tragedy. And I suppose that's what Woody Allen often explores in his work. In this film, he keeps it on the side of love.
No, but I think Maria Elena, when she's into that conflicted and disturbing relationship, she already comes with a big background of trouble, because she was told as a little girl that she was a genius. And she has this idea that to be special, she has to continue to be the tortured artist. So she doesn't allow herself to be happy. And I know a lot of people that live in that trap.
Tell me about working with Woody. I want to go back onto the set and what he was like, because his humour is extraordinary. He keeps making films with these fantastic female casts. And every actress I speak to that's worked with him just falls slightly in love with him.
Because Woody is very charming, very, very charming, and very funny, and very honest, and he says things the way, you know, there is no social veneer with him, which is very refreshing. And he's also very kind, you know, and when you're working, he really takes care of his actors, and not with the actresses, it's just with all of us. Every actor you ask would tell you how much they love him.
Yeah.
Woody is very, very, very kind.
And was it different for you? Because Scarlett's been working with him for the last three movies. They're like old friends. Mm. Was it easy for you to kind of come in there, or have they still got their little special twinkle?
No, but I love seeing that. And then Scarlett and I became very good friends. Yeah. And yes, and with Woody, I got along very well from the first day. He always makes me laugh so much.
I would have loved him. I don't know if you'd ever discussed this, but if he'd have narrated the film, if he'd have done the voiceover for the film.
Yes, I wanted him to do it too. I think everybody wanted him to do it. I don't know why.
Because it sounds like him. You know, you can hear his voice in it. Not that it's badly done at all, but it just seemed perfect for him.
Yeah, I don't know why. I would love to act with him in one of his movies.
He does that less and less because he's getting, you know, he's quite old now.
He might do it again.
Have you told him you want to act with him?
Yes, but I haven't told him about acting together.
Yeah, well, you see, that might tempt him back, Penelope. Yeah. Well, I wish you the best of luck with Marielena's life afterwards on the red carpets.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And the muy, muy, muy linda Penelope Cruz can be seen in Vicky Cristina Barcelona on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 6th of February. You're listening to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. It's now time for that hallowed bit of the show where we run the rule over the week's releases. And joining me to do that is Guardian film editor Andrew Pulver. Welcome to the pod, sir.
Good morning.
In the stead of Zan Brooks, Andrew is standing in, and he and I will be discussing the curious case of Benjamin Button, Vicky Cristina at Barcelona. I'm going to tell him about Doubt, and he's going to tell me about the good, the bad, and the weird. That sound all right?
Sounds great.
Let's start with The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, then, Andrew. It's directed by David Fincher, 13 Oscar nominations, 11 BAFTA nominations, starring Brad Pitt as a man born under unusual circumstances, they being that he's born old and he gets younger while we get older. So when he falls in love with Kate Blanchett, they do somewhere meet in the middle.
You certainly are beautiful to watch.
Dancing's all about the line. Line of your body. Sooner or later, you lose that line. You never get it back.
I figure you were born in 1918, 49 years ago. I'm 43. We are almost the same age.
meeting in the middle.
We finally caught up with each other. Wait. I want to remember us just as we are now.
So, Andrew, it's a kind of love story in reverse, but I find it's an odd film that they're kind of billing it as a love story because it's kind of a lot more than that.
Well, I think it's 2.5 hours, isn't it? And
yeah.
They pack in an enormous amount from where he... I think he's born at the turn of the century in New Orleans, as far as I remember.
He's born at the night that the First World War ends.
That's right.
A very good night to be born.
Yeah, and... And he lives up to pretty much the present day. And he is one of these characters who sort of end up being coincidentally at the site of famous things that are going on at the same time, like the Apollo 11 launch and all that sort of thing. I think what it's intended to be is a sort of everyman character who experiences all the sort of ups and downs of the 20th century. Having said that, question is, does it work?
That's the main big question. I mean, 13 Oscar nominations and 11 BAFTA nominations suggests it does, or that people who work in film think it does.
Peter Bradshaw, our critic, had a very good point that we have to say he really hated the film. I don't know whether we should sort of spill the beans on that. But he did make the point that there's an element of wish fulfillment, he thinks, about Hollywood executives, that they kind of wish they were getting younger as they were getting older and richer.
Well, I think that's the point of the film, isn't it? I think most people out there try. I mean, I look at the papers today. John Cleese is admitting to sort of running, running repairs, I think he calls them. We are in an age that puts a lot of value on age.
I think, though, that the film does have higher aspirations than just merely being a sort of satire on the sort of our social obsession with youth, by sort of delineating this relationship between the woman who's getting older and the man that's getting younger. What they're trying to do is make points about the sort of lasting nature of romantic love. Does it last? Doesn't it last? Can it be as passionate when people are getting older and sort of more world weary as they are when they're young, and the fact that they're experiencing these at different points within the relationship.
Yeah.
To me, that's the main serious point he's making.
And does he do it well? Does it work? Because I think it does. I think it's, I mean, I know Peter hates the film, but it does require one to have an appetite for whimsy, an appetite I usually don't have. But this is a fable, and I do think it's a kind of heightened fable.
I mean, I have to say that I do agree with you. I mean, I found it an engaging watch. It doesn't drag for me at all. I suppose why Peter hated it was very easy access with these sort of ideas.
I just don't think it is. I think it needs work, this film. I think it's about a very weird film that asks you emotionally to respond to it while it's going on. And you're thinking, hold on, he's old, right? So he's now, but he's young because he hasn't experienced anything. So he's like a kid who's old. And then when he's a little baby, he's, you know, so he should be full of wisdom of the life. But he actually isn't because, of course, he's in dementia. So that's extremely sad, I thought, to see a baby who's senile, in a way.
Absolutely.
As it is sad to see a misshapen, kind of a razor head kind of baby that he is when he's born.
Yeah.
Quite horrific.
Yeah.
Who then kind of says, I'm seven. And it asks you to do loads of maths. It asks you to kind of rethink every single scene, like stories do.
I think what it is, maybe perhaps it's a very, very high concept idea. You know, there's a basically, it is actually remind me of time travel thrillers that I actually saw another one this week, the Hatcher Review, that was a Spanish time travel thriller called Time Crime. And again, time travel films are very simple in their idea. You just move in time and go back an hour or go ahead 2 days. But it forces you to do all these sort of brain-wrenching sort of stuff. So it is a sort of cheap intellectualism in a way that it forces people to use their brain. Same as con movies, I always think. Things like The Sting are actually very intellectual, even though they're quite simple.
They're puzzles.
Quite easy to understand. They're like jigsaw puzzles.
Finch has done this in the game, in very particular.
Absolutely.
He likes doing that. And he did it in Zodiac as well, where he was actually, the man was obsessed with crosswords, for example.
Absolutely.
So there's all these kind of on-screen games to do. And I think this one asks you to do it.
Yeah.
I've seen it compared on our website, no less, to Forrest Gump,
because
it's got this kind of down-home southern wisdom kind of shot through it.
Same scriptwriter.
And it's the same scriptwriter, Eric Roth, who people could say, well, he peddles the same ideas, but he does take time out to do things like Munich. in between. So he's not really kind of obsessed with this thing, I think. I found this a very beautiful film, and I had to go and see it again twice because I was aware of the groundswell of hatred against it. And I thought, well, and I saw it really early, and I thought this was rather good and ineffable in a way, and made me cry. And it made me cry again. And this isn't because I'm so fond of Brad Pitt's beauty that it makes me swoon. I just thought this was a very good use of Brad Pitt as a model, in a way. Brad Pitt's performance is a bit, I don't know, he's not there half the time. He's CGI'd onto a little old man quite a lot. But there was something very amazing about using this icon of cinema to kind of get younger. And suddenly, halfway through, poof, there he is, like we saw him in Thelma and Louise. Bang, there he is, like Joe in the, like we saw in Meet Joe Black. Then he is, like we saw in Seven. It's kind of an amazing sort of watch.
I do think, though, it is telling in some way that particularly Cate Blanchett's had no sort of acclaim, particularly for her role. And I don't think anybody's taken Brad Pitt seriously to win any actual awards for this. I think people are admiring the sort of tour de force of it, the technical side of it. Perhaps it's difficult to empathise completely with them as people, as characters, and that's kind of why there's a sort of step back from it generally. It is quite strange for Fincher because he's known for pretty dark, nasty kind of material, and he has, and him trying to kind of go sappy and soft is a bit strange. I actually saw a sort of little documentary with him talking about it on Film 4 channel. I don't know if I'm allowed to plug that. I've sort of interviewed him a couple of times in the past, and he's quite a tough bloke. Yeah. You know, he's not afraid of saying what he thinks. And he was talking on this film in a voice that he seems to have deliberately made about three octaves lower and softer than normal. And I sort of do get this feeling with him particularly that he's decided, right, it's time to make a real kind of Hollywood number, and you know, I'm going to really try and get some Oscars with this one. And I suppose you sort of feel, is it really natural territory for him? Wouldn't he much prefer to be sort of eviscerating someone with a chainsaw or something? Don't know.
Maybe I think that quite a lot of the critics are doing that for him, to his own work.
Absolutely.
Actually, you can see myself and David Fincher in conversation, him using that little voice to try and convince me that what he'd done was right, although he had me at hello. It's on my Guardian In the Director's Chair series. Just click on guardian.co.uk/in the director's chair. Andrew, let's move on to another auteur attempting to rediscover form. It's Woody Allen in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. Vicky and Cristina go to Barcelona. Scarlett Johansson and Rebecca Hall, they're being seduced by Javier Bardem, who happened to be married to Penelope Cruz, who's a bit balmy.
I am Juan Antonio, and you are?
Cristina, and this is my friend Vicky.
I'd like to invite you both to spend the weekend. We'll eat well, we'll drink good wine, we'll make love.
Who exactly is going to make love?
Hopefully the three of us.
This guy, he doesn't beat around the bush. Look, senor, maybe in a different life.
Andrew, a Woody Allen fan like myself, what's his recent career done for you? I mean, it kind of plunges me into despair when I see everyone kicking my poor hero, Woody Allen.
I think we have to be realistic about Woody. I mean, as I always say, you know, he had this fantastic run of films from the mid-70s to the mid-90s that were, you know, in my opinion, you know, one of the great sort of runs of any director. Yeah. I think his personal troubles have taken a toll on him. His sort of, and he hasn't, frankly, he hasn't aged all that gracefully. And everything we now say about Woody Allen is kind of relative because he really did, you know, lose it artistically. I think particularly, you know, for me, Match Point was an absolute low point.
You didn't see Scoop and Cassandra's Dream in that case.
I think Cassandra's Dream, I think I did see, and although horrific, wasn't as bad as Match Point.
I like Cassandra's Dream. My name is Jason Solomons, and I like Cassandra's Dream.
I actually never saw Scoop, I have to say.
No one did. Yeah, they didn't release it here. But they are releasing Vicky Cristina Barcelona, and they are heralding it as a return to form, and it is looking like being like his highest grossing film since Crimes and Misdemeanors. I mean, it looks like it's a hit. And what's wrong with, you know, what's not to like with Summer in Barcelona, three of the hottest actresses in the world, and Javier Oscar winner Bardem in there? Can Woody handle it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one thing that you sort of realise is that all actors all have a great respect for him, pretty much dating, I think, since Hannah and Her Sisters, when he got Michael Caine an Oscar, which I think surprised and stunned everybody. And since then, actors, you know, really big name actors have been queuing up.
Surprised Michael Caine even more. He wasn't even there, was he? He was off filming Jaws 3.
Yeah. great career he's had. anyway, you know, Woody Allen can handle actors like that. I think the question is what he's doing going to make the best use of them? And my feeling is with this film, he's done something in retrospect quite clever, which is, I think the thing that made his quote British film so awful was that he was trying to write films about British people set in Britain as if kind of he was British, and that's, you know, he's obviously hadn't got the first clue about what life here is like at all. So that was just idiotic.
Well, like you say that, but
whereas this film is about a bunch of American tourists
in Spain, exactly.
In Spain, so
it might have been better had he done the Americans in Britain. Yeah.
So the fact that he's very superficial about and basically hasn't really got much of a clue about Spain either, it doesn't really matter because
people said Match Point when it was just tourist brochure, go to Buckingham Palace. But it's fine in Barcelona because that's what American tourists do, and they go around going to the Sagrada Familia.
And they are, you know, and that's what the characters are. So the characters don't really jar like they did in Match Point or Cassandra's Dream. That's, you know, basically why I think it works.
For me, I have to say, Andrew, that although I love Woody Allen, always defend him to the hilt, this one, which I first saw in Cannes, and people were guffawing, falling about in laughter, I just thought, this is not funny, this film. It didn't do it for me. I thought this was one of the most kind of bland of any of his efforts. It didn't take me forward at all. I've seen it all before. And with Cassandra Dreamed, I thought, God, I've never seen this before. Even with Match Point, I thought, I've never really seen him do this stuff before. It was odd. They were odd. This one isn't even odd. This is just boring.
You know, he's never going to be great, I don't think, ever again, which is sad. I mean, for me, his last really great film was Deconstructing Harry, I think, and I think it's sort of basically been bumping along the bottom since then. I sort of watched it. I found it funny. I think Penelope Cruz was a revelation because, I mean, you know, not wishing to be too hard on her, her English language films have been absolutely awful, mostly because she never could speak the language
very
well.
She's gorgeous in our interview, and she's gorgeous when you meet her, and I'm absolutely in love with her. But I just thought this film was a bit of shouting.
You know, I thought she was funny. Yeah. You know, I thought this is the first time I've actually seen her act in English that sort of she sounds like she's saying things that she actually means, as opposed to sort of having learned something phonetically off a blackboard, which I think was the truth.
I can tell you, she did the interview without a blackboard, without phonetics.
Well. I'm sure she's fabulous.
Yes, exactly. Now, you've seen a Korean film this week, The Good, the Bad, the Weird, which I managed to avoid because it looked absolutely balmy. Is it?
It is balmy, but in a pretty good way.
Okay, Andrew, let's just hear a clip of The Good, the Bad, the Weird.
Well, what it is a Korean Western that is a tribute to The Good, Bad and the Ugly, you know, the Sergio Leone spaghetti Westerns. And
a noodle Western.
A noodle Western, absolutely. And it is an extraordinary film in many ways. It's unbelievably violent. I mean, really horrible, you know, people getting their hands...
Oh, right, because the marketing I've seen looks like it's a comedy.
It's kind of funny in some ways, but in that same way that, you know... those spaghetti westerns had their flashes of black humour, you know, Clint Eastwood, you know, shooting the noose down and all that kind of stuff. In the film, there is a good character, there is a bad character, and there's a weird character. He's ugly as well, but he's basically weird. He's the one who's supposed to be the funny guy, and as often with a lot of kind of cross-cultural humour, doesn't travel that well. But there's a lot of other stuff going on with this very sort of ambitious spaghetti western storyline. Essentially, what they're doing is that there are these three people. They're all after this treasure map, which is owned by the Japanese government during. It's actually set during the Second World War, and there's this sort of very odd subtext about the invasion of Korea by the Japanese, and about how the Koreans are trying to get their country back, which is quite odd. I sort of suppose there's always a political subtext in spaghetti westerns as well that. That they're always about the exploitation of Mexico or sort of poor people or whatever. So there's an element of that in there. But it's quite strange having all that stuff.
Special effects in it?
Well, there's a lot of this kind of violent special effects stuff, you know, said people getting blown up or shot.
Right, there looks sort of extreme, lots of jumping sort of, and flying that they like to do.
Yeah, there's lots of that wild work kind of stuff.
Clint Eastwood
would
never have done that.
He certainly wouldn't.
That poncho never had wings.
But it sort of reminded me a little bit of that... very strange Thai film called Tears of the Black Tiger. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, which, it reminded me of that.
Which is another one of these sort of kitsch westerns taken completely out of context and plonked down in the Far East, which is... obviously, Tears of the Black Tiger was a lot more quiet and studied than
It was almost poetic.
It did have its sort of great Sam Raimi bits, but there's a lot more frenetic.
There is another one. Is it Takeshi Miike done one called Django Western Blues or something?
Oh, I never saw that.
Yeah, don't see that either. Yeah. It's not my favourite genre, as you can hear. But let me choose one of your probably not favourite genres. The Catholic nun potential priest molesting genre.
Right. I failed to see this one.
This is the film Doubt, which, of course, everyone in it is brilliant because Amy Adams, Meryl Streep, Philip Seymour Hoffman and Viola Davis have all got an Oscar nomination, but no one likes the film. Or I assume that's why, because the film doesn't get any nominations at all. It is set in 1960s America. It is a Meryl Streep as the head of a nunnery, and Philip Seymour Hoffman is accused by her of molesting a young black boy whose mum, Viola Davis, doesn't care because it's a better school than the normal schools. Let's just hear a little clip. It isn't Nuns on the Run. It is Doubt.
It's me that cares about that child, not her. Has she ever reached out a hand? That black boy needs help or he's not going to make it. And she sees me talking a human way to these kids and she immediately assumes that there must be something wrong with it. Well, I'm not going to let her keep this parish in the dark ages. And I'm not going to let her destroy my spirit of compassion.
I'm sure that's not her intent.
That I care about this congregation.
I know you do.
Like you care about your class. You love them, don't you?
Yes.
And that's natural. How else would you relate to children? There are people who go after your humanity, sister, to tell you that the light in your heart is a weakness. Don't believe it. It's an old tactic of cruel people to kill kindness in the name of virtue. There's nothing wrong with love.
The world of nuns and Irish Catholics in 1960s America, it's not a world I cared to be transported into.
I mean, my theory about it was that it's quite a hot topic in the States with the kind of child abuse scandals.
Well, I mean, I love the Magdalene Sisters that Peter Mullen did.
Mullen,
I thought that was brilliant, about much the same sort of system of abuse and the same institutional abuse. And I like films about institutional abuse. I think they're very sort of important. This one was just the filming of it, directed by the guy who wrote it, John Patrick Shanley. It's just so boring. He knows it's the stage play. And every now and then he tries and does a shot from the light or does a little thing at a little kind of odd angle because he knows that it's so boring that he has to kind of try and go, look, I'm a film director. Hey, look at my wonky camera. Andrew Pulver, thank you so much for joining us today. You can, of course, read everything that Andrew thinks and writes at guardian.co.uk/film. You've been doing the Pulverdrome of late. You're resurrecting forgotten films that you like and no one else did.
Yeah, it is a sort of tribute to Alex Kotz's Movie Drome and... I just thought the Pulverdrome, that's a place to be. Yeah,
I can imagine it kind of full of acrobats and horses and bikes whizzing around at gravity defying speed.
Yeah, well, you know, that's kind of partly the idea.
What's next for the Pulverdrome then?
I think next week I'm gonna go for, or next month I'm gonna go for the John Cusack teen trilogy. I think that's something I've always really liked. Sure Thing, Better Off Dead, and Say Anything.
Yeah, I like those.
It's either that or Bertolt Brecht's sort of cinematic oeuvre, which is not huge.
So is this you just going, look, these are really good. I really like these.
Absolutely. I mean, that's pretty much what the column was, designed for in my mind, just to sort of just be able to sort of impart some of the stuff that I've sort of built up over the years and never really get the chance to write about any other way. So
brilliant. Editor's prerogative. Andrew Pulver, editor of Guardian Film. If you'd like to take issue with anything you've heard on Film Weekly between me and Andrew, you could be like Sean James Bell, who writes, this week, I've got to disagree with your podcast review of Revolutionary Road. Sam Mendes' style isn't to everyone's liking, but you can't deny the power of the performances. So if you want to take issue with me or Andrew or any of the reviewers on Film Weekly, please join us on Film Weekly Fans on Facebook. Not since Walt Disney himself has one creative mind had such an effect on the history of animation than the director, producer, and writer John Lasseter. So it's entirely fitting that the Pixar founder was made chief creative officer at Disney in 2006 and has since gone on to steer Disney back to the road of popular success with films such as Cars, Ratatouille, and WALL-E. His latest Oscar-nominated film is Bolt, part Truman Show, part Lassie Come Home. It's the story of a TV dog with TV powers who's convinced that he's the real deal until he's forced to step outside the studio and begin the biggest adventure of his life. I met up with the normally reclusive but colourful John Lasseter to find out more about the man behind the pixels. But first, let's get a taster of Bolt, voiced by John Travolta, as he gets a reality check.
Look, genius, you're part of a TV show. You know what that is, television? It's entertainment for people. It's fake. Nothing you think is real is real.
That's preposterous.
Think about it, Bolt. Since you got lost, none of your powers are working, are they? For the first time, you're hungry, you're bleeding. I mean, do you really think that you were born with a birthmark in the exact shape of a lightning bolt?
It's my mark of power, Cat.
It's the mark of a makeup artist, dog.
I'm Jason Solomons. It's Film Weekly, and I'm joined now by John Lasseter, head of Disney Animation Studios now, and a man, I'm proud to say, wearing a floral kind of Bolt animation Hawaiian shirt.
I'm so happy to be here, and yes, I'm sporting the official Bolt Hawaiian shirt.
It's a look, sir. It's a good look.
Is the shirt too loud for radio? Should I turn it down?
We should turn it down.
Yeah.
You also have a Mickey Mouse watch.
I do. Look at that. A classic one. Isn't that a beauty?
My next question is I'm wondering what your underwear looks like.
I would be happy to show you.
Let's keep that off radio as
okay,
well.
Okay, good.
I mean, the reason I mention this thing is because you live and breathe these characters, I assume. They must take over your life, John.
Well, I love it. You know, I'm a big kid, and I realize in animation you don't have to grow up. I have a huge toy collection, right? I'm really into model railroads, too. I just love all of this stuff, but I love making cartoons. I love making animation. You know, I love entertaining audiences, I think, is the thing that I love. It just, the greatest reward is really like last night we had a screening of Bolt, and just sitting there watching the film with this audience and hearing them laugh.
I was part of them.
That was the great, it's just a great reward for me. You know,
I wonder, because it was a reasonably adult audience. In fact, it was at the National Film Theatre. We weren't at the Victoria Station cartoon Sunday morning thing. This was a sophisticated, cinephilic audience.
Right.
Who were laughing at the animation. Do you think that audiences for animation have changed? I mean, look at WALL-E, another one, a production which I assume you oversaw in some capacity.
Oh, absolutely. WALL-E is our film, too, yes.
Won Film of the Year from the Los Angeles Film Critics.
Absolutely. You know, we're so proud of that.
Are we all infantilized? Are we all just big kids, or has animation hauled itself into the mainstream and now deals with adult themes?
Well, you know what's interesting is that when you look back at the history of animation, Walt Disney made his films for everybody, for adults as well as kids. Chuck Jones, the great Warner Brothers director, is a big mentor of mine. I love his films. All those Warner Brothers cartoons with Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd and the Roadrunner and Coyote, they were made for adults.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until television, and really like in the 60s, early 60s, they started putting animation on in Saturday morning and after school and primarily in kids' hours. And so the whole mindset of animation shifted to where it's, oh, animation, cartoons, oh, they're just for kids.
Right.
But they never were intended to be that way.
And of course, Tom and Jerry won an Oscar, didn't they? The Beethoven Cat, one of my favorite pieces of animation of all time, is an Oscar-winning short, really, isn't it?
Yeah, they've been giving out an Oscar for an animated short film or cartoons for 70 years, you know, and so it's, you know, it's not until the recent, you know, with Roger Rabbit, Little Mermaid, around that time, that animation, adults started rediscovering animation and saying, hey, this is actually entertaining. All of our films have things in it for kids and things in it for adults.
Well, I thought Bolt was terrific. I know you didn't direct Bolt itself, but your executive producer.
No, I creatively oversaw it, worked very closely with Chris Williams and Byron Howard, the directors. This story is so special. It's about this dog that is the star of this TV show. And it's an action TV show. Mm. And in the show, he has superpowers. And he's raised on the set of this TV show as a puppy. And they don't let him get off of the set. And they go to great lengths to make him believe that all this is real.
Yeah.
Because as the director in the movie says, you know, if the dog believes it, the audience will believe it, you know. And And so it's like method acting gone awry.
One thing that you said last night at the Q&A that you wanted Disney to kind of recapture the love that we have for Disney.
Yes.
And, you know, my favorite is The Jungle Book, and then Robin Hood I have a very soft spot for. Yeah. And one thing I noted about the Pixar, which are absolutely beautiful, and I think they're moments of just absolutely stunning beauty, which are in Bolt, they're in Cars as well, pastoral kind of scenes
yes.
that I just love. But the music, John, are you looking to up the musical ante and back to that kind of musical that the Sherman Brothers used to write those jingles?
Yeah, I love the musical. What's interesting is when we were getting started making feature films at Pixar, it was when the Disney Animation Studio was doing these amazing musicals, right? Beauty and the Beast, Lion King, The Little Mermaid, Aladdin, so on. And we didn't want to do that.
Right.
We wanted to be different. So Toy Story set us off in this other road. Now, coming back to the Disney Studios, I want them to recapture that spirit. We're actually in production. We're returning to hand-drawn animation at the studio, which is great. And it's a musical. It's called The Princess and the Frog. It's a fairy tale set in New Orleans, and it's Randy Newman is doing all the music.
Oh, okay.
And it's a breakout and song musical, and it's going to be
That's
spectacular.
That's what I want an under-lily-lily-eye moment.
You're going to have it with this. It's a fantastic musical.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to that. John, congratulations on Bolt. Wish you the best luck with that. And congratulations on heading up Disney. I mean, that's kind of the biggest job in film, isn't it? Very
yeah.
responsible.
Well, I'm very proud of it because I got Disney blood going through my veins. I was even a ride operator on the Jungle Cruise at Disneyland in Anaheim, California, when I was going to college. So I just love every aspect
right,
of Disney.
You're qualified.
And
this
so
is
I'm
good.
So proud to be back
it's
there.
It's in good hands.
And Bolt is a terrific film. We're so proud of this film, and it's definitely a return of great Disney animation.
Well, congratulations on it, John. Thank you very much for coming on Film Weekly. Honour to meet you.
Great. Thank you very much.
My thanks to John Lasseter there, which almost brings us to an end for this edition of Film Weekly. I've just got time to announce the winners of last week's competition. You may remember we had three copies of Unrelated on DVD to give away. That's Joanna Hogg's superbly nuanced debut feature that won the Guardian First Film Award. I asked you a bit of a convoluted question, but then I wanted to get you away from just looking things up on Google. It's hard work winning a Film Weekly prize. This one was, I asked you which great British actor-director was connected to one of the stars of Unrelated, actor Tom Hiddleston. The connections being a Swedish detective series, a West End play, and a film set in Tuscany. So, that was, of course, Tom Hiddleston is in the Swedish detective series Wallander. He's also been on the London West End stage in a production of Chekhov's Ivanov. And this film was set in Tuscany, which was also the setting for Much Ado About Nothing in 1993, directed by Kenneth Branagh, who starred as Ivanov in that London West End play, and, of course, plays the title role in Wallander. Phew, you got there in the end. Amazing, but you did. John Gill from Fife in Scotland. Will Gore, who's got no address but entered on an iPhone, so respect there. And to Daniel, somewhere in the UK. Those DVDs are on their way to you. So, best of luck to all my guests this week, to Penelope Cruz at the Oscars and the BAFTAs, to John Lasseter at the Oscars. Thanks for all of those who entered the competition, and thanks to you for listening. For now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.